Welcome to the J3 University Podcast. I'm your host, John Jewett.
And I'm your co-host, Luke Miller.
Our mission is to elevate the physique coaching standard
and deliver the highest level of competitors to the stage.
Let's jump into today's episode. Carb cycling is overrated, or is it underrated? So that's the question that we're going to prompt you with today and dive into it, because it's a tool that's been used for a very, very long time. I remember reading Dr. Mauro Pasquale's book, and he had a cyclic diet approach that he utilized, which was real extreme. It was like some keto days, then rotating carb days, and that was actually my first time using some type of approach around that. Then we've had different iterations of carb cycling come about, and now that we're in this real bodybuilding hypertrophy realm of the research world, we're having other studies come out. So Luke and I will dive in today around, is carbohydrate cycling overrated, underrated, and what should you be doing?
Yeah, I think what's up, man? I think it's a great conversation, because the devil's in the details, right? I think we can start to go to some extreme versions of everything that we do, where we start to see detriment in that process of implementation with clientele in the real world. And we can do that both directions, in the extreme carb cycling or the extreme variance or step away from carb cycling, where like we're just isocaloric across the entire week. And I think that there's value in discussing, does all the benefits that carbohydrate cycling is touted for, do they take a place in a client process, and do we actually see that anecdotally happen? And then where is it valuable and where is it not? And so that we know that this is a tool that we can use, but it's possibly not the best tool in our tool belt, and it's possibly not the only tool that we could utilize with client setups, because it seems like two sides of the aisle with this. People either love it or they hate it. There's no middle ground of trying to meet people where it's useful kind of in contextual situations.
And like if you are a coach, usually you want a variety of tools in your tool belt to be able to deploy, because you're going to have a variety of clientele that could come across. Now you're going to have clients that come to you specifically for what is the John approach or the Luke approach that we deem as being optimal. And sometimes people want to fit, you know, into that box when really they shouldn't be. But a lot of times, if what someone has a buy-in for could very well be the best plan for them, because they're going to believe in it, they'll put more effort and energy into it just because of that, those things as well. So yeah, people that really enjoy carbohydrate cycling, and they do better with it for that exact reason. While you might have someone else that the changing patterns and a dietary adjustments could cause undue stress, and that might not be for them. I think the first premise here is, what is carbohydrate cycling? How do you even put, kind of define what that would really look like? And like I said, there's lots of variations amongst this, but the simplest way is that from a day-to-day basis, there is some rotation in the amount of carbohydrate being consumed. Usually that also correlates with the amount of calories being consumed too. So typically you might have days that are higher carbohydrate, also in turn higher calorie, and then days that are lower carbohydrate and lower calorie. And that could be based around if you're having a non-training day or an off day from the gym completely, right? Doing old cardio only, or it could be based around when you're training. If you're resistance training, that might be the higher carbohydrate day. Now, the degree to which that varies could be fairly vast, and being very high carbohydrate or very, very low. We also see this carry out throughout, whether you're off season or even contest prep, with different variations. Some are doing these days just a non-set pattern. Could be like every other day goes high, low, high, low. Or you might have someone that runs a string of low days and then has high days back to back. You have some people that are doing like a keto, kind of keto approach, right? It's like protein, fats, then you have high carb days. So there's lots of different variations around this. I think even getting into some of the literature around intermittent fasting or intermittent caloric restriction, you see a similar setup too. There's times of fasting and then also times with high caloric input too. So this is almost a rotationary pattern of, consistent caloric restriction versus this rotation of caloric restriction. But in the non shorts, short description of that I just gave, that's essentially what we're looking at. And so whether you're building muscle or losing fat, what we want to know really for Zeke is like, hey, what's the best way we can build muscle and lose body fat or stay leaner while we're building muscle? And, does this have application to us? And so what is the rationale behind doing this? And if we know the rationale and the whys, maybe we can look at how they line up with the evidence. And if that has some good backing behind it, maybe there's parts of it that we absolutely should take away from those rationales, parts that we should leave. And that should probably dictate how we actually apply it into practice. And that's not to ever take away also from what we see out in the trenches, because anecdotally is where we all start. And then we test these things, different variables in the research world, and try to figure out why we see what's happening and why we see what's working. So rationales behind doing it, Luke.
I, as someone who went to grad school at USF, and Dr. Campbell's like 5 and 2 was one of the early kind of introductions to this carbohydrate cycling and data that we have. And it's something that was discussed ad nauseum across the entirety of my grad school as a result and being there, right? So I think where value lies in this conversation is picking out some of these rationales that we see proposed, showing, do we see each rationale valuable or not, and kind of where that applies within carb cycling. And I'm going to kick it off with the one that I love. And the reason I love it is because I use it for this reason, is the psychological break that carb cycling can provide. Now, I know there's physiological reasons that are touted, which we'll get to in a second, about like, could there potentially be physiological benefit with carb cycling? But for me, the psychological profile of an athlete is the hardest to manage, yet the easiest to resolve when you figure out what makes them tick. And for some people, carb cycling makes them tick. You tell someone that we're going to run a high-low dynamic, and they're like, yeah, I'm ready to grind, and then get rewarded at the end of the grind. And that setup really tailors to their desire to work through the prep in this up and down fluctuation. And as a result, it pulls more out of the athlete because that's how they resonate with that. And then we're going to have people on the other side of the aisle who struggle with hunger signaling so bad that they just can't stand low days, because these low days are typically, once you get towards the dog in a prep, they get really low, where it's potentially not the best way to manage a client psychologically within that contest prep setting. Because for me, I'm always looking for ways that not only physiologically make sense, but in the trenches pull the most out of my athlete. And when we look at carbohydrate cycling, this is actually my favorite reason why I use it, because I've pulled a lot more out of athletes that I needed to pull more out of by switching them to a setup like this with carbohydrate cycling.
Yeah, I think the psychological benefit around having like a non-monotonous diet is a big thing. Even the off season, especially if you're having an extended off season period where it's the same thing every single day. To have a day where you're like, oh man, it's going to be different today. Like I'll have like more food. I will say there's some people that I do coach like that still are on fairly low food in the off season, and their off days just really suck psychologically for them. Cause like, man, I'm like so much hungrier on this day, but at the same time, then they have like the next training day to look forward to.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, that's perfectly fine. I think where you run into a couple issues is that how you're programming around like untracked eating on those days. Cause if you're going to be having a plan where some people might try to go lower on their low days in order to make up for untracked eating on like a high day. And that could lead into like a really large calorie excursion on one day. And then your other days, your low days, having to go even lower. And I think problem lies on a few aspects around this. For one, your low days could be sub maintenance. If you're in a say you're in an off season state, right? And we know like a bout of training, protein synthesis can be elevated for up to 36 hours, right? So we can't just look at the duration just around training of just that 12-hour time period when we're eating. So even recovery is extending beyond into your next day, which could very well be an off day. And so if you're now moving to a caloric intake that is way below your maintenance, you very well might be limiting your ability to recover via protein synthesis, because we see once glycogen levels start dropping down that there is a decreased rate in those recovery aspects around protein kinetics. So it could get to a suboptimal state rotating like that for the person that's trying to like really go super hypercaloric on their high days or their carbohydrate cycling days where they have training based around it. Or they save up the calories for the end of the day, which it still probably want these aspects spread out throughout the day. You know, there's some idea around, you know, really driving a lot of insulin around this training window, and doing so and having a very high carbohydrate intake in the off season, we run into eventually, especially with enhanced lifters, losing some insulin sensitivity and potentially, you know, what do you do around that? And that's the idea of like, well, you have this high day with high insulin levels and driving a lot of, you know, recovery around the training session. And then the low day is to help restore and deplete down some of this glycogen level. But it truly comes down to the area under the curve, because we have in the literature where if you have someone that has a large excursion in calories in one day, like a cheat meal, the following day, they also have a decrease in insulin sensitivity and higher insulin output on a meal by meal basis. So in other words, your body's accounting for this either way. So on the one day, you're losing some insulin sensitivity, but you're just having to make up for it on the other day. Versus maybe if we had something that a little bit more even keel, you wouldn't run into having any detriments in insulin sensitivity, but not going so hypercaloric or allowing on top of it your untracked meals to occur, or for that individual that really drives into trying to push their foods around to just get more untracked meals in the off season. And that's one of the biggest mistakes I see. People get fat really quick by doing that and having like lots of untracked meals on like their higher, harder training days. You'll see body weight jump up like the next day after that meal, and it just never comes back down. Then the rest of the time they're doing like lower or moderate calorie days, which aren't supporting recovery as well. And they end up just getting fat on those couple days and having to run a deficit the rest of the training window.
Yeah, I think to kind of piggyback off of that too, just like the potential detriments, I start to go into performance retention, because I think the extreme versions of carbohydrate cycling in either direction, all season or prep, I mean, I think prep is probably more specific to this issue, where you see the low days be so low across the week. And I'm specifically thinking about the 5-2 dynamic that's been proposed as like a potential. It's like those 5 days across the week, like
they ran a 35% deficit on those days.
It's like, how are you supporting training performance across those 5 days consistently once you get a little bit deeper into prep? Because those low days are going to get low and your performance is going to start to suffer across those 5 days. And then you're going to have those two high days and you'll have good training session those 2 days and maybe the day after, but then you're just going to be right back down in the dumps. And so that's where we start to go on the extreme version of the carbohydrate cycling, where for tissue retention across a contest prep, performance retention is the core of that stimulus that provides retention strategies. And if the low days are so low that it's not allowing you to retain performance, like you're just doing yourself a disservice in optimizing that process.
I think that's where you are seeing when nutrient timing starts to matter, because there's like articles out there where timing doesn't matter. And for certain aspects, it doesn't, right? Like hitting your total protein goal for the day is kind of what matters and evenly distributing that. But then you get in the question around, well, what about carbohydrate? Because we see like after a training session, glycogen resynthesis is elevated for within, you know, 24 hours. As long as you consume enough carbs in that window, you're going to be good. But when that changes is when someone is glycogen depleted, because we see going into a training session, normally you don't completely deplete glycogen for most people. Now, this is most people doing maybe a low or a moderate volume training session, also maybe around an hour. You see maybe muscle glycogen decreases like 40%, which is not going to be enough to cause like training performance detriment. However, what about someone that's already glycogen depleted that already needs a higher amount of volume and doing a longer training session. And maybe they also had to do cardio that day. Now, carbohydrate timing absolutely could have more impact on that person's training performance and also their recovery, because they might have to do a repeated bout of some type of form of maybe cardio or leg training more frequent. So I think as you get deeper into the contest prep, these rotationary patterns and the timing of carbohydrates start to really matter for training performance. And better training performance means better retention of tissue. Now, earlier on, when you're fat in a prep, you have so much food that you're not going to get glycogen depleted yet, which wouldn't really prompt the need to do a lot of these rotationary patterns. But again, it's a tool to be utilized for when you are seeing performance detriment, maybe moving to a rotation pattern. And it makes a lot of sense too, because as you're getting leaner, you should be slowly decreasing that deficit so you can preserve muscle tissue more efficiently. So that's when you should be bringing in more of these high carbohydrate days. But like we talked about, you know, in another podcast, push them hard out the gate. You don't need refeeds when you're like 15% body fat. You don't need high days. You just keep the deficit relatively steady. Maybe for some people psychologically, you give them like one day that has a little bump in food. I know, Luke, we talked previously, we see more of the benefit of off the early end, just giving them a pullback on a rest day of like no cardio, low steps, like just resting. And in turn, that brings them up to more of a caloric maintenance.
Yeah, that's your surplus if the air quote high day is the removal of the activity on that one day during the week or the 2 days during the week or whatever that looks like for that client. I think that's probably more beneficial off the forefront when you're trying to get someone moving fast. Now, I want to propose the glycogen supercompensation conversation, because I think that's something that needs to be discussed in regards to, you know, this cyclical version of carbohydrate cycling, and is this something that we need to think about in regards to carbohydrate cycling, and get your opinion on it, because it's certainly touted as like a potential benefit.
Yeah, well, I think when you're seeing it in a contest prep scenario, you are having someone that's more glycogen depleted to where they're in a place where they could supercompensate glycogen. Mm. The thing around it, though, is that usually in contest prep, if you really had someone that to supercompensate glycogen that much, you just have to put in context where they're at from a fat loss and point of prep to where you need to pull back down and keep losing body fat. So if we're really like to supercompensate glycogen, like the actual data around that, usually you're giving like 6 to 10 gram per kilogram of body weight of carbohydrate per day. So if you're a 220 pound male, this is like 600 to 1,000 grams of carbs over a 24 hour period. And that's usually done for like 2 days. So we don't have that kind of timeline on a prep, which that is true, like supercompensation of glycogen beyond what you can normally store. Yep. So that's a state, an environment where absolutely could be done. We're not taking refeeds or high days to that extent because we don't need to go that far. And it takes away from the ultimate goal and prep of driving them back into fat loss, right? Now, there's a degree of it that's going to occur. But the idea of putting in that type of dietary approach is not just to drive up super compensation, because we need to put training performance across the whole week into context. So if we're depleting someone down so much to where we're having sessions in a row that are poor training quality, just to then compensate glycogen and maybe have a couple good ones, we should maybe scale it back to where we average that in that intake across the week to where, hey, we have, you know, some good moderate training sessions across the week, but never really poor sessions or really great sessions. And that might be, you know, to where you could scale a more moderate approach around some body parts that you see that start to drift maybe towards that tail end of prep. So if you're going to time these higher carbohydrate days around the days where you have your body parts drop off the first, that could be some good rationale. But where this really changes for glycogen supercompensation is when you're already in a glycogen relatively full state, which is the off season. In the off season, there's so much carbohydrate already present that you're never going to reach a full, like, depleted state to see supercompensation occur. And, you know, with that being said, like, how many calories do you truly burn, like, during a session? Which is something good to know. And on average, it's about 6 calories per minute of training. There's other studies if you kind of, you know, in consideration, these aren't large individuals doing large volumes of training, but we see it kind of range from 150 to 500 calories for some. Yep. Now, I would say like the 6 calories per minute could align well for a lot of people, which, you know, you easily could have even a 90-minute session for a large bodybuilder could be 800 calories, or you could have someone, I could easily see someone expending 1,000 calories doing larger volumes for a good chunk of time who is a big individual. Now, 800,000 calories, that's 100 grams to 120 grams of carbohydrate, which, I'm sorry, no, it's actually a little bit higher, right? Yeah, that could be like close to like 200 grams of carbohydrate. So that might be the rotation that's in place, right, for that individual, just to account for the expenditure that's going to be greater around that day. But like I mentioned earlier, 24 hours after a session, glycogen resynthesis is elevated. So as long as you consume that amount of carbohydrate across that time window, you're relatively going to be full again. Now, other thing in context, though, is that how often are you training that muscle group? Because usually for us training in bodybuilding, it's maybe every 3 days, some body parts once a week, right? So it's not just a 24-hour window. You're going to be consuming enough carbohydrate across the next 5 days to replete glycogen in that muscle. Highly likely. Yep. So to go beyond what is needed to expend within that training session doesn't make a lot of sense, because after that point, you're going to be just spilling over and having to accrue that into body fat, which then the idea is the next day you go really low to account for that too. So it's, you know, why don't you just even out those scales a little bit more? Cause you're in a glycogen loaded state to where you're not going to supercompensate, and to actually deplete the next day is where you run into the issues of probably recovery parameters, having to go so low to then just load up glycogen when we could have not had to go way over the top to lose sensitivity or go way under to deplete in the first place. But I do think still that there is rotation to be done. And also considering that when someone trains, right? So if you have someone that trains first in the morning, are you going to do your high day on that day, or should you do it the day prior?
Day prior.
And so that's when you run into, well, you might need to have more of these moderate days with a setup for someone that is like that. So,
yeah, I also want to, go ahead. No, you do.
No. Go ahead.
I just, one thing to combat of something that gets proposed to me that's along the same vein is just like lower body performance / fullness with cardiovascular activity in play. People proposing like high days around leg days in order to limit the depletion that occurs across a cardiovascular session. And I think what that more comes down to, rather than running specific high days, is timing your cardiovascular activity better. And this is where a lot of times I actually prefer people to run their off day from cardio the day after legs rather than the day of legs, depending on how much time they're able to give themselves between the session and the cardio session and the leg session. But if there's a long enough time, which typically is 6 hours plus between those activities, then I see a lot of utility in removing it from that day after to aid in the recovery process post the leg training session, because of that extension of needing to get food in from a recovery capacity standpoint post the stimulus that's been provided.
Yeah, I think, hey, your rest days, use them for the purpose they're intended to in the off season, and that's to recover. So don't create these days that are going to impede recovery all around, from how you're programming the diet, how you're programming, you know, cardio. They should all be supporting that ultimate goal that we're after. So I always think, like, what is the ultimate goal? How do you structure all the variables around that goal too? And I remember a long time ago, like when I did work with Jansen, because I came from a point before working with Matt where I was doing a little bit more of an aggressive rotationary pattern. And Matt doesn't really do that for a few reasons. For an assessment purposes, if you're having large rotation in the days, it can also skew times that you're also seeing an assessment of your clients from a digestive point of view, from a water retention point of view. But also, I remember Matt always told me, he's like, your rest days are prioritized for recovery. So that's what we're going to do with how much we feed you. And Matt pushes food hard, and also why his guys grow really well. And so that always stuck in my mind. I grew really well with Matt to make sure, like, you do prioritize your rest days around recovery. And for the individual, that's just looking at, you know, if you're doing cardio, is it horribly fatiguing the next day following legs? Then we might need to adjust the timing around that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Another thing I see is the fear of the very extremes of high carbohydrate, low fats on days versus, you know, very low carb, very high fats on the other days. And I will say, like, from a adherence point of view, man, I remember eating like these really large rice meals. And they were so hard to get down without fats. Now that was probably me back in the day, like not really knowing how to make meals more palatable, because there absolutely is a way to cook better. Mm-mm. Not eat cold chicken and rice. So the diet can get a bit boring that way. Without like a little bit balance of carbohydrates with fats, which the idea being, if carbohydrates are that high, insulin and fats together could cause a greater amount of fat gain. And this has been well established to be just not true. It just truly comes down to the total caloric surplus that you're in really across the week. But I still say by the day is important for how that's going to weigh out. Because you have this someone that consumes the biggest surplus on 2 days, it's going to be a lot different impact than across, you know, spread out through across the week. And, you know, this goes back to the carbohydrate insulin model of obesity, where the driving factor around obesity is high insulin levels all day.
Yeah.
And we have like plenty of research around this showing, you know, protein matched, hypocaloric, different amounts of carbohydrates or fats being present. It makes no difference as far as in changes in body outcomes. There was even another study done with a 6-week intervention being hypocaloric, a balanced versus a disassociated diet. And what they did is basically it's a macro balanced diet across the day versus having like protein carbs, protein fats, protein carbs, trying to really separate out like fats from that insulin response. And it didn't make a difference. So basically it still comes down to the end of the day. What is your total caloric surplus that's going to drive that process? Because, and you probably remember this, Luke, like when they do these rodent studies to create insulin resistance in them, they actually don't feed them carbohydrate. They overfeed them on fats to make it happen.
Yep. Which just even further shows like the incidence of that in humans is, we could look at that and carry that across, right?
Yeah, it's more so you're driving this inflammatory pattern in high surplus, high body fat gain, mm-hmm. and that in turn leads to the insulin resistance, not necessarily directly from carbohydrate, directly from fat or insulin in and of itself. So there's a whole environment that's taking place that's making that occur, which with that being said, you know, that's the idea around what should we really probably be doing if you want to maximize muscle gain, limiting body fat gain, and then within contest prep or dieting, you know, maximizing muscle retention, losing the most body fat possible. And there is an idea too around this rationale that, hey, you'll stay leaner doing it this way, and in turn still gain as much muscle. But to do that, you just have to stay like in a smaller surplus. And usually if you do that, you might just be limiting yourself in muscle gain in general. I've tried to do the lean gain off season approach, and man, it was kind of discouraging because when I did diet back down, I was the same stage weight that I was the previous year. It like felt like I lost a whole year of off season.
Yeah. It's I mean, and there's even evidence of that. I think there's some data on like football players about line versus skill athletes versus where we're kind of seeing like more tissue accrual across like the linemen with slightly higher body fat accumulation relative to the skill athletes.
Yeah. Well, there was, I think it was last year, there was a big, like it came about P ratio.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That there's a, as you increase in body fat, There's going to be, for one, a blunting of muscle gain and a greater partition towards fat gain. Then as you get leaner, it would go the opposite way. So the more like insulin sensitive you are, the greater partitioning towards muscle gain there would be. And this is off some like, it's a data set that's just really extrapolated and has shown out to not be very accurate either. So the idea being, hey, if you're very insulin sensitive, you should gain a lot of muscle tissue. And if you're getting more insulin resistant, that it blunts hypertrophy. And that just hasn't held up well. Cause we see for one, if we took the drug component away, right? Looking at natural athletes post show, they're very insulin sensitive, but their whole hormonal environment just doesn't cater muscle gain really well. So there's a point when you get so lean that your recovery parameters are going to be diminished. Like think about it right now, my sleep is shit on prep. Like that's not great for muscle gain. Even though I'm very insulin sensitive and I have drugs in place. Yes, I could gain muscle now because of drugs, but it's not like I could gain when I'm sleeping amazing, right?
No.
Or I have less fatigue from just cardio and stuff, steps. And so there's a sweet spot, right, where you don't want to go too lean because that's going to impede recovery parameters, but also going too fat. What about that? And that's the study that Luke is bringing up. And again, it's a retrospective study, so it's not an intervention, but
yeah,
they took different skill sets and looked across like a year of entry level, the first year of college for these different skill sets of football players. There's like linemen, they broke them down by what, low skill, moderate skill, big skill. I don't know. I don't follow much football. Someone's going to assume this. So
big guy, whatever. Small guy.
Like whatever, running backs. And then they had linemen and they're looking at muscle gain across these groups. And the linemen were like over 20% body fat. And they actually gained the most muscle comparatively to the other groups. Now, what about the calorie surplus, et cetera? But kind of point being here is that it doesn't seem that muscle gain gets impeded from someone getting to a higher body fat level. Now, with that being said, we still have physique issues around this that we need someone to be able to diet back down for show. Mm. Also, using PDs, we have health parameters that could be bottlenecks for individuals to keep adding on size. So usually like blood pressure gets too high, lipids are skewing, we're seeing someone having more digestive issues occur. And so now it's just getting suboptimal. And we do start seeing maybe more fat gain for that same return of muscle gain. That's not impeded necessarily, but we're going to have to pull that all off at some point. And how the duration of time you have to do that for is probably going to make up for if you had just cut it off early. Yep. So point being here is that there's a good body fat range to work within, but it doesn't seem like chasing down insulin sensitivity is the metric that we need to be looking at around that. It's one to monitor for health, but I think we get too focused on just one thing and not looking at a global person when we're actually assessing them.
Yeah. So
what do you actually do? What's the takeaway? What matters here for like muscle gain? Is it, you know, is it carbohydrate cycling? And you know, the big thing to address is like the nutritional hierarchy is, you know, that's what we teach in J3U. That's what's going to really matter first and foremost. So what makes a great diet? And that's a great diet is the one that you can stick to. Now for your hardcore bodybuilders out there, this is not the issue, right? Like we can eat
whatever
you tell me what to eat. I'll eat it. I will adhere, but there's a lot bigger influx of other competitors now earlier on. And we, you know, as a coach, you want them to be successful. So you need all these tools in your tool belt to help with adherence, to help with sustainability, to make them enjoy the process more. Yeah. So that's your first thing from there. Then from there, you know, we're programming calories total is what matters across the week. Your macronutrients from there is what matters across the week. Your total amount of protein, carbs, and fats from there, you might weigh in which one matters more. Is it nutrient timing? Is it food sources? And I think it comes down to a mix of both because you need to make sure you're filling in micronutrient gaps, also fiber, because you might run into roadblocks with health metrics or digestive issues that prevents all the other stuff from carrying out its job. At the same token, there is some nutrient timing aspects that will matter for certain situations. And then finally, the very last part of our pyramid here is, dietary supplements and programming those in.
Yeah.
And then, we could put, drugs in there too, which that's also going to be a determinant of the rate of body fat to rate of muscle gain. That's an important factor.
Yeah. And I think if you set up a client for success with like the daily habits and they've either one got that on lock or two, you teach them to have that on lock with the execution of the day to day, it makes the clarity in the nutritional adjustments within that baseline nutritional hierarchy way easier to see, because you can run rates of gain that are normal that you would normally see like in that surplus direction, kind of in that 0.25 to 0.5% per week. If you're in that deficit, depending on phase, like probably somewhere between 0.5 to 1.5%, and you're just adjusting these caloric intakes that has the baseline of micronutrients and fiber intake and all of this kind of stuff that you set up from the beginning, you're just making those adjustments to stay within those rates. You're not going too far into a deficit or too far into a surplus. And it all operates off this baseline of consistency where, keep it simple, stupid, like just... coach the client, watch the response, to make the adjustments according to that. Be aware of this nutritional hierarchy so that as you make adjustments down, if you need to change food sources to keep fiber intact for motility, then you're doing that. Or if you're needing to change food sources to get more micronutrients in for an athlete that might have deficiencies, you're doing that. But it's a lot of times if you do it right from the forefront and understand what creates that nutritional hierarchy and you help a client be consistent with their day-to-day metrics, it makes your decision-making week to week so much easier.
Yeah. Bodybuilding is relatively simple. Like there's some big major takeaway points here that are going to get you almost all the way there, right? Train your ass off. At least for everyone. A lot of people, when I walk in the gym, a lot of people just aren't training hard enough. That's going to be your huge driver into putting a ton of muscle on. Train really freaking hard. Stay fit and healthy, because that's going to be a bottleneck for your enhanced users. And then, like Luke said, managing just a surplus, don't get overly fat, prioritize your sleep and recovery. And then with our, PD users, just escalate that over time. It's as freaking simple as that. So these conversations around how much carbohydrate should I cycle from training day to my non-training day, it almost doesn't matter. As long as you're meeting like the big picture criteria, that's going to get you most of the way there. Yeah. The nuance in that, it's important. We're going to have conversations about it. But if you're not doing the other aspects, it's not going to make as much of a difference. So train your ass off, sleep, recover, escalate PEDs, don't get overly fat and stay fit. Like those things are going to take you very, very, very far. Now, if you're going to implement carbohydrate cycling, if it's for you, absolutely can do it. It's not wrong. Just don't go to the extremes. That would be my true recommendation around it. You typically, like how we program, might just have it based around the extra expenditure that's going to be around the training day and prioritizing some carbohydrates pre and post workout. So I usually, in my diets, I like to do 40 to 50% of the carbohydrate for the day is prioritized around the peri-workout window. And then on the off day, the only thing that changes is that that extra carbohydrate intake just comes back down to a baseline intake. So it's as simple as that for how I typically program. But again, I can go and utilize carbohydrate cycling to an advantage. If I need someone that maybe they need a little extra food on the weekend, we could shift some over there. Or the person that, hey, I need simplicity because I'm a very busy, individual with my work. I need almost the same thing every day. Absolutely have that approach too. So utilize what you need, because there's some flexibility within the approach of utilizing carbohydrate cycling.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had some people do so well with just the same diet and training day just introduce intra-workout carbohydrates, and that's just literally the difference that you run because they're that busier person, right? So it's like, just find what works for the client and just get them moving. And as long as you don't go to those extremes, like John said, you're going to move the client in the right direction. So I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's just use it where it's needed and fit it to the athlete.
Yeah, that's it, guys. If you have questions or comments around carbohydrate cycling, leave them down below or tell us how you like to cycle your carbohydrates. And for us at J3U, if you want to dive into more, we have a whole nutrition module that covers all this of how we actually do it, how you might apply it, and utilize it within a framework for you. Until next time, we will see you then.